Today at Reader's Corner, Dana Stevens, author of Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema, and the Invention of the 20th Century. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Born the same year as the film industry in 1895, Buster Keaton began his career as the child star of a family slapstick act, and later, he along with a few other actors gave birth to Hollywood. In Cameraman, film critic Dana Stevens focuses the lens on Keaton's life and work and covers concurrent developments in entertainment, journalism, law, technology, the political and social status of women, and the popular understanding of addiction. Dana Stevens has been Slate Magazine's film critic since 2006. She is also a co-host of its long-running culture podcast, Culture Gabfest, and has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, The Atlantic, and Book Form. Dana Stevens, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
And I probably ought to finish that title. It's not just Cameraman. It's Cameraman Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema, and The Invention of the 20th Century. And let's start there. It's 1895. This Buster Keaton comes bursting on the scene in this little town in Kansas. What was going on at the time that, in a sense, as you said, gives us this image of Buster Keaton as a human projectile hurled into the 20th century?
Yeah, well, this was sort of the what launched the book in my own brain was this fact, which you'll often read in Keaton biographies, that he was, quote, born the same year as cinema. I mean, it's hard to say exactly when cinema was born because there were many different technologies that converged at the same time that different people were working on. But generally, its birthday is celebrated in 1895 because that's the year the Lumiere brothers in France first projected movies to a viewing audience, as opposed to, you know, the kind of Thomas Edison machines that already existed where you would have a little, you'd sort of peep into a box and grind a crank and look at a movie just for yourself. But the first public viewings of movies are in 1895, which also happens to be the year Keaton is born. And that convergence, which has often been observed in biographies of Keaton, just really got me thinking about the fact that if he was born alongside cinema, that means he grew up alongside it, that his formation happened at the same time as this really important technology and art form was starting to figure out what it was. And so that's what the book tries to trace, really, is sort of to look at the way that that technology and how it changed America and the world kind of wove in and out of events in his life. Mm-hmm. So if you buy this book looking for a Keaton biography, you may be disappointed because it's not a soup to nuts treatment of his entire life. But what I try to do is pull the camera out and look at him in the context of that time.
So tell us how he gets started with his family, this vaudeville act, I guess. What's that all about? And we'll take it from there.
Yeah, well, the remarkable thing in researching the beginning, the first few chapters of this book about his childhood, was to see how quickly he turned his act, his family's act, the Three Keatons, into this huge success. You know, it's not the case that he was, as many kids were at the time, born into a successful act and kind of taught and trained by his parents to be part of what they did. It was more like his parents, he was their first child, his parents had this very unsuccessful act that was, you know, on the verge of failing all the time, you know, to the extent that they were going cold and hungry the year or two before he was born and barely getting work. Then they have this little boy who at about the age of five, it's not exactly certain, but it seems like he had just turned five probably. He joins them on stage. And within 6 months, I mean, you can trace this in, you know, newspaper coverage of the time. Within 6 months, they're headlining the best vaudeville houses. And almost every review of the act in vaudeville papers and things notes that it's this little boy who is the driving force of the act. So it was just sort of remarkable to watch this slapstick prodigy, you know, kind of change his family's history and really bring them into the top rungs of the entertainment mm-hmm. industry at the time.
You have a quote that I thought was very interesting. It's his life with miraculous elegance happened to coincide with the invention of a technology that records the very thing he was unsurpassed at, movement. So give us just a glimpse of one of these vaudeville acts. What's he doing there with his parents? What makes this such a success?
Yeah, it's something of a mystery because, of course, none of those acts were ever recorded. I mean, film did exist at the time, but nobody thought to use it to record these stage acts that were the main form of entertainment at the time. So there isn't any filmed record of their act, but there are quite a few descriptions of what the act used to consist of. And it seems like the basic premise of the act had to do with this father-son interaction between Buster and his father, Joe Keaton, that in our eyes now, looking back from the 21st century, was sort of, you know, like a humorous version of child abuse on stage. I mean, essentially his father would come on and start giving this kind of lecture about parenting. I think it would differ from night to night, but, you know, he would recite a poem or sing a song about how important it was to be a gentle and forbearing parent. And then, dramatic irony, the whole time he was doing that, his son was behind him on the stage up to some kind of mischief that sooner or later his father would become aware of, and then proceed to throw his son all over the stage, you know, kick him through the scenery, throw him into the orchestra pit. It was a really, really violent roughhouse act between father and son. And Buster's mother, Myra, had provided the musical part of the act. So she would be, you know, come on and play saxophone while her son and husband were going through all this mayhem behind her. Mm-hmm. And that was precisely what the audience loved about it. They were known as the most violent act in vaudeville, and that was what drew people in. And if you think about the grown-up Buster Keaton and, you know, the way he gets laughs in his movies, it just seemed to me that he's always performing that same kind of dynamic on a larger and larger scale. It's either a big man who's menacing him in some way and throwing him around, or as the movies get bigger budget and more elaborate, it's nature itself, you know, and tornadoes and houses collapsing on him and the world itself that's conspiring to kick him around.
Now, you also treat, speaking of how roughly he was treated on stage, you treat the subject of child welfare, the child welfare movement of the late 19th and early 20th century. In a sense, it collides with the Keaton's vaudeville act, does it not?
Yeah, and that was why I wanted to get into, you know, what it meant, not just this particular act and what it was about the three Keatons that appealed to audiences despite or because of maybe the violence, but what that meant in the context of the time, because it just so happens that the turn of the 20th century, the same moment that, you know, he's going on stage, I think 1899 was the year he went on stage, is the moment the child labor movement is beginning and the first cases of child abuse are being prosecuted in courts. It wasn't a crime to do whatever you wanted to your child until, I don't know, around the 1870s or so. And compulsory education laws are being put in place, which Buster Keaton never got to benefit from because he never attended school. He was always touring in vaudeville with his parents. But this whole concept that, you know, children are a special class of citizen that need to be protected by laws was a new concept at that very moment. So I sort of use him as a test case, right? The boy whose fortune was made by being kicked around on stage, you know, and what that meant in the context of early 20th century childhood.
Did the child welfare movement or the law ever catch up with the Keaton family in the way the father was treating Buster?
I mean, they were always catching up with them, and then the Keatons were always evading them. And if you read Buster Keaton's memoir, you know, about his years in showbiz, he always strenuously denied that he was at all abused or unhappy. I mean, he was also an extremely stoic person who would never have admitted that if he were, but he loved to tell stories about how they were always evading the, you know, essentially the child welfare cops, the people who represented the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, a pretty new organization at the time, who were led by this guy that I write about named Elbridge Gerry, who was a really important force in child reform, child labor law and child abuse reform, and who took a specific dislike to the Keatons' act and decided that he was going to make them an example, I guess, because they were so highly visible on stage. And so every time they came to New York State, which is the only place that society had jurisdiction then, you know, he would try to find a way to shut their act down. And they would try to work around it. Like, for example, when they knew agents were in the audience, sort of vetting their act, they would tone down the violence and do something much more family friendly. Then as soon as they knew that they had, you know, for that particular town, they had passed muster with the society, they would ramp everything back up to the same level of violence again. But yeah, they did have their act shut down several times because mm-hmm. of child labor practices.
I couldn't help but think how far we've come. I saw in your book mention of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children and thought of today's, I think there's a Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and today when you do a movie, you actually have to state somewhere at the end of it that no animals were harmed in this movie.
And right. Well, actually, this is fascinating, Bob, that the Animal Society preceded Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, and I write about that a bit in the book. It was out of the animal abuse movement, which was a little bit earlier in the 19th century, that the child abuse movement began. And in fact, in some of the very first, you know, child abuse cases, that was cited as a precedent. Well, we're protecting animals. Shouldn't we be protecting our children as well?
Right. So how does Buster break into film?
that happened in 1917, which was another big year. I mean, I would say that 1895 is the first big year that my book revolves around. And then the next chapter of his life begins in 1917, which is when he's in his early 20s, and he shuts down the family act. He quit the act and broke up the Three Ketons, really because of his father's abuse, even though he never would call it abuse. His father, as he got bigger and harder to throw around the stage and started to grow up, his father started to drink more, started to be more violent on stage and off with Buster and his mother, and it became really untenable for the three of them to keep performing together. Mm-hmm. So there's a very dramatic scene in around 1916 where he and his mother flee the act and leave his father drunk and alone at a stage door, you know, with his stage trunk, and just escape. And at that point, Keaton had been supporting his whole family, including by then he had two younger siblings, his whole life, really. It was his, you know, talent and on stage that kept the family going. So he knew when the act broke up that he had to get some more work fast. He initially lined up some work on the stage and was trying to conceive of how he would become a solo act. And then through an encounter that I've described in the book, he happens to meet Roscoe Arbuckle, now better known as Fatty Arbuckle, who was a really important comedian, both in front of and behind the camera, a director and a comedian, who had just gotten his own film company. And he was about to start filming his very first movie. And because of this chance encounter with Keaton, who I would imagine they knew each other from the vaudeville circuits, et cetera, he said, "Hey, why don't you come down and watch a movie being filmed?" There wasn't really a plan to put Keaton in it, but he wound up improvising a stunt, being in that very first Arbuckle production, and then becoming very quickly a part of the company and essentially Arbuckle's co-director and very close friend. So that was his apprenticeship time. Mm-hmm. And those years, 1917 through 1920, are where he worked alongside this other director, kind of learned his chops behind the camera and in front of the camera. And in 1920, he inherited that company from Arbuckle and started the Buster Keaton Studio.
You're listening to Dana Stevens. She's the author of Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema and the Invention of the 20th Century. And she's obviously the expert in this because she's the film critic for Slate Magazine. Well, the title of your book, Cameraman, I suppose tells it all because, of course, Buster Keaton was not just the actor. He was the guy behind the camera, and that was one of the films he did, wasn't it?
They have The Cameraman. I love that title. I didn't come up with the title. A friend did. But I mean, I love that title both because, yes, it echoes one of his movies in 1928. He's in a film called The Cameraman, which is one of his greatest films. But it also, I think, sort of traces the two things that the movie is about. It's about the man, you know, about this person and this individual biography, but it's also about the camera and about how that technology, the moving picture camera, changed culture, you know, changed entertainment and changed the way that Americans live.
I was really surprised to learn that in 1916, a higher percentage of women were directors in Hollywood than had been the case in any year since then.
Yeah, including now. I mean, that's an incredible
amazing
statistic,
yeah,
that made me want to devote this whole chapter. I mean, as you'll see, if you read Cameraman, there's whole chapters that are hardly at all about Buster Keaton, although I hope, you know, the idea is that they still all weave into the story I'm trying to tell involving his life. And one of those is this chapter, as you mentioned, that's all about women in the 1910s in film. So, mm-hmm, yeah, in those early years of film, when it was still sort of the Wild West, you know, as a business, yeah, and had not yet really congealed into, you know, an industry with the studios that we think of from the golden classic era of Hollywood, there was a lot more space for women to be both in front of and behind the camera. So there are all these big, big figures who are not just actresses in front of the camera, but, you know, own their own production companies, and they may direct their own films or co-direct them, co-write them. They're their own stunt women. You know, mm-hmm, I mean, to make a movie was a very different thing in the 1910s than it became just a few years later. And in those Wild West years, women had a surprising amount of power. But of course, as one might predict, at the moment that the movie industry starts to become big business and big money and, you know, something that's internationally important for the U.S. economy, that's the moment women start to get phased out. And it so happened that that coincided once again with something important in Keaton's life, that moment in 1917 I mentioned when he enters the movies. And so that convergence seemed like it was worthy of looking at to me, because that's kind of the missing piece, yeah, from a lot of histories of that time, like what happened to the women.
Yeah. And do we have any idea why women were predominant at that particular time?
I mean, I think it's simply the case that, you know, like I was saying, they're half the population. They had a lot of creative, yeah, things to contribute. And at that moment, nobody had yet tried to take it away from them. And I talk in the movie about a moment. Well, Mabel Normand, who was a famous actress and also directed a lot of films at the time and worked at the Keystone Studios with Mack Sennett, she's the main figure I concentrate on in that chapter. And I describe a moment when she directed Charlie Chaplin in one of his earliest movies when he had just moved over from the stage to film. And you know, there's a moment when he sort of usurps her authority and sits down on set and refuses to work and won't do the joke that she wants him to do and wants to do his own. It's a particular story between two people about one guy being stubborn with one woman, but it seemed very exemplary of the way, you know, women were at that very moment being unseated from positions of power in film. Mm-hmm. And so I concentrate a little bit on that story and that moment when, you know, Chaplin was not yet famous, he's about to become one of the most famous men in the world. Right. And, you know, Mabel Normand, who could have been the female Chaplin, is starting to get phased out.
So tell us about the film Seven Chances, Dana, and how it depicts the change in the culture's popular feminine ideal.
Oh, that's a great question. Okay, well, Seven Chances is one of Keaton's lesser films, actually. It was not one of his favorites of the films that he made and was a pre-existing stage property that was kind of forced on him by his producer. But I talk about it quite a bit in the book because it is a movie that talks a lot about women and the image of women, because the premise of Seven Chances is that Buster is a bachelor who's about to inherit a fortune, but he will only inherit the fortune if he's married by this particular date. And it's all sevens. I'm not going to remember now, but I think it was like, you know, the day he turns 27 by 7 p.m., he has to have a bride in order for this will to go into effect. And so it's all an excuse to, you know, have this kind of romantic domestic comedy about women and him, you know, asking all of these strangers if they'll marry him, trying to get his girl to marry him. Everyone says no. And I like to talk about that movie because of what it shows about the change in the status of women in the 1920s. And the movie is from 1925. And it's already a completely different world from the way courtship and romance are shown in his films of the early 20s, you know, which are really sort of Victorian. Like there's a sweet young damsel who he wants to court, but he has to go and meet her father and her scary brothers first. And he pays a courtship call and it all feels like something from a 19th century novel. But already in 1925, you know, a moment when women were starting to enter the workforce in bigger numbers and to, you know, the flapper image was starting to take over pop culture, there's already a very different image of what courtship is. So, you know, Seven Chances is all about that. It's all about his failure to pick up a girl, essentially, and all the rejections that he gets along the way. And it ends, and this is the best part of Seven Chances, in this spectacular chase scene where he goes to the church where he was supposed to be at 7 p.m. to get married. He places a classified ad saying, you know, bachelor wants bride. And I think he mentions the fortune. And so hundreds of women show up at the church and he winds up getting chased through the town by, you know, this horde of marauding brides. And it's a fantastic chase that ends the movie.
Now, is he writing all of these movies that we're going to be talking about?
Yeah, I mean, writing when it's a silent movie, writing is an unusual term. He didn't write the intertitles for his movies, but that isn't really what it is to write a comedy, right? I mean, to write a comedy is to figure out all the gags and the jokes and the flow of the story visually. And that he did do. He did it with his team of gag writers, and he had a very trusted, you know, when he ran his own studio, at least, a very trusted team of gag writers who understood his sense of humor and his particular screen character and helped him come up with the stories. Mm-hmm. But he used to brag to journalists who interviewed him about this, that everything they wrote, you know, the whole story for a feature film could fit on a postcard because what really was about was coming up with gags and also something that Keaton loved, you know, building or finding these sets and locations where you could make gags out of whatever was around you. He came up with the stories himself for sure. He also, and this is something that wasn't credited at the time on screen, but he edited his own films. You know, he was very hands-on in that way. He was the guy in the cutting room deciding when a scene began and ended. So when you see a silent Buster Keaton movie, you know, it's pretty much all coming 100% from his brain, although he did have lots of collaborators that helped along the way.
By the way, for our listeners who want to see Buster Keaton in action in some of his films, if just maybe just one, where do they go?
You know, I should have said this in the intro to the book because it's something important to know as you're reading it. All these movies are so available. It's not as if you have to, certainly you don't have to find them playing in a theater, although I hope that theaters will stay alive and keep showing them on the big screen because there's no better way to see them.
Yeah.
But they're almost, you don't even have to rent them. They're almost all in the public domain and they're streaming for free, either on YouTube or on archive.org is a good place to look for them. Mm-hmm. And I really wish I had said in the intro that the book and reading it should be an interactive multimedia experience. And as you go, if you're curious about a movie I mentioned, whether it's his or Mabel Normand's or anyone else's, you can just go find it and watch it and then keep on reading.
Yeah, well, that's what I did. I'm reading your book, and then I'd go onto YouTube, and we're going to talk about his most famous scene of the house falling on him. We'll get to that in a little bit. But, I was just amazed. It's like, hey, this is really cool. I didn't even know this stuff was on YouTube.
It's a really great resource, and it's a moment that you're really glad that the public domain exists, you know, yeah. That it really means something. Like once a work of art reaches a certain age, yeah. It belongs to everybody, and it should be. It should be out there. I mean, I would also say that, you know, if you really get into this stuff and you're really interested in Keaton or silent film in general, it's also great to support physical media and get the physical media versions of these, because that way, not only are you seeing it in the best quality, you're seeing it in the way somebody at the time would have seen it. You know,
yeah,
there's scholars that are making sure, oh, this is restored and all the shots have been put back in the right order. And it's the kind of soundtrack it would have, you know, you would have heard at the time, maybe not the exact same music, but it's a more authentic experience. And of course, there's often great extras and commentary and so forth.
Right. So today, many of us, before we go to the theater, will check the movie review. That goes all the way back to its birth, right there with Buster Keaton. Tell us about how that takes off. I guess it had something to do with a guy named Bob Sherwood.
Yes, well, there's a chapter about him, a critic named Robert Sherwood, who wrote for Life magazine, the old Life magazine in the 1920s, before it was the sort of photojournalism magazine that we think of. There was a version of Life that was almost like what the New Yorker is now, you know, sort of urbane collection of, you know, criticism and art and cartoons. And the Life of the 20s was run by this guy, Robert Sherwood, who was also its film critic for almost all of those years, and who happened to be a huge Keaton fan. So I have a whole chapter about Robert Sherwood, because of his long-time relationship with Keaton's films, and also because, to me, he's sort of one of the inventors of film criticism as we think of it now, you know, which is that there's a particular critic with a particular voice who writes for a publication, and you go there to hear what that person has to say. You know, that it's not, as film criticism started out to be, something that's anonymously authored by a bunch of different people and put into one column. No, it's not just little blurbs about what a movie is about, but it's analysis and relating films to the culture at large, so that when you're writing about a movie, you're really writing about all of American society. I think Bob Sherwood was one of the first critics to write like that, and so was a very influential one. And he just also had a particular relationship, both personal and, you know, critical, with Keaton that I wanted to write about. He was such a fascinating figure who also, you know, fought in World War I and wrote speeches for Roosevelt and won the Pulitzer Prize for drama, and actually ended up writing the screenplay to The Best Years of Our Lives, the wonderful movie about returning veterans from World War II. So he just seemed like such an exemplary figure of the 20th century that he needed a chapter of his own.
So Keaton had a serious problem with alcoholism. It seemed to permeate every facet of his work and life. I wonder if you could tell us about that, and how does Alcoholics Anonymous and Buster Keaton cross paths? You have a quote in there that says, "Drowning 4 shots after leaving rehab is hardly what AA had in mind."
Right. Yeah. Well, there is a chapter about the birth of AA, which happened in 1935. And about Keaton's year of 1935, which had nothing to do with AA, and which, as you say, was, you know, in a way just the opposite. It was the year he went into rehab of a very different kind, you know, a much more brutal form of rehab for his own alcoholism. And the year that he, quote, got sober, in the sense that he exited the acute period of alcoholism that marked this one dark part of his life. But he never got sober in the way that we think of it now with 12-step programs. And he, you know, did it alone, and, you know, it wasn't entirely successful. He went on and off the wagon for the rest of his life. But I wanted to write about that year because, well, both because I myself hadn't known that Alcoholics Anonymous was such a recent creation. And, yeah. I was just struck by how much it's changed the way we think about addiction in those years since 1935. I mean, the idea of a disease model of alcoholism, right? That alcoholism is not a character flaw, but is a kind of internal physical and emotional struggle, was something that was entirely new. And if that had existed, if that mindset had existed during the years when Keaton was in this darkest place, which was the mid-30s, basically, he might have had a completely different trajectory for the rest of his life. So it's sort of an almost near miss. You know, mm-hmm. It's not the case
right.
that he crisscrossed with that new way of thinking about addiction. It's that he could have and yet didn't, you know, that seemed so tragic. But I also want to emphasize, though, that it's not at all the case that Keaton's story is some sort of, you know, Hollywood biopic cliche about a brilliant artist brought down by drinking and ruined forever. It's not at all the case. You know, there was a very dark and difficult time for him because of drinking and because of the sound coming into the film industry and his marriage falling apart in the mid-30s. But he really did pull his way out of it. And I think the last, you know, third of his life or so was a very happy and productive time for him. So I wanted to end on that note because I think he ended on that note and did not regard his life as some kind of crushing failure just because, you know, he lost so much in the middle.
You're listening to Dana Stevens. She's the author of Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema, and The Invention of the 20th Century. I think we've all heard of silent film stars who just never were able to make the successful conversion to talking movies, but you point out that Buster Keaton did that. How does that work?
Yeah, that seemed like another myth to dispel in a way, not just about him, but about that moment in film history. I mean, there's no question that that was a very violent transition for a lot of people in the film industry when sound came in, because it was a very, very sudden change. And no one, even the top executives in the film industry, often thought, oh, this is a fad, it's going to pass, you know, or there'll be both, you know, silent and sound films will somehow continue to coexist. And that wasn't at all the case. Within a year or two of The Jazz Singer in 1927, the first, you know, big picture using sound, although it wasn't all sound, you know, the entire industry was switching over and theaters all over the country were trying to rewire themselves so that they could show sound movies, and careers were ending and careers were beginning. And it was certainly a time of violent transition. It's not at all the case that the careers of Keaton and other silent stars whose careers founded in the 1930s we're all like, you know, the woman in Singing in the Rain who has a horrible voice and then her career is ruined because of it. There were a couple cases of bad voices maybe, but in general, it had much more to do with popular taste changing, you know, the style of humor and romance and acting that was in fashion started to change, and the industry itself changing so that, you know, the technology of filming was very different and the economics of making movies was very different all of a sudden. And the reason Keaton loses his studio at the end of the silent era wasn't because his voice was bad. It wasn't because, you know, his comedy was out of fashion. It was really because of the economics of running a small independent kind of mom and pop operation like the one he'd been running, funded by his brother-in-law and producer, Joe Skink, for all of that decade. That wasn't viable anymore. You know, movies were being churned out now in a more factory style, and you needed brighter lights and you needed microphones all of a sudden. And so everything was changing in the way movies were made. And as a result of that, he becomes a contract player at MGM. And he goes from being, as we were saying, the editor and co-writer and producer and the general mastermind behind his movies to being one of a stable of contract stars at MGM, this big factory system. And it just did not suit his temperament at all. He was utterly miserable without having creative control and input over his movies. He didn't know what to do with himself. And that's the period when he starts to drink too much. Formerly incredibly strong work ethic starts to slacken for the first time. His marriage starts to fall apart. And very rapidly, within a few years of joining MGM, you know, he's a total mess in his personal life. But, and here's a really sad part of that story, on the contrary, his early talkies at MGM in the early 30s did really, really well financially. In fact, some of them out-earned any silent movie he had ever made. So it was, in a way, even more depressing than, oh, this poor broken-down drunk making terrible movies. It was this poor broken-down drunk making successful movies. So, you know, I think he felt really trapped in mm-hmm. that situation.
Why is The General considered Keaton's crowning achievement in filmmaking?
You know, it's considered that for sure. I'm not sure that it's my favorite of his movies, but it is unquestionably one of the most him of his movies. It's an utterly Keatonian invention that could only have come out of his own brain. And if you haven't seen The General, it's a movie set during the Civil War that is essentially a train chase. It's a comedy based on a real event where a Confederate train was stolen by some Union spies and taken across the lines. And then there was a train chase. And eventually in the real life story, a far darker ending than in the movie, The General, the train thieves were caught and hung. But what happens in Buster Keaton's The General is that this one engineer played by him goes back after his beloved train, which is named The General, and sort of single-handedly rescues it from these train kidnappers. Because Keaton loved technology, right, and he loved gags about technology, he loved trains in particular and had grown up living on trains. His whole life was fascinated by railroads. It's just something that feels utterly out of his brain. So it's I've just seen it in the last few weeks several times on the big screen, showing it for book promotion events and so forth. It still plays incredibly well after almost 100 years, and it is a brilliant film. I would say that it's considered his masterpiece probably because of, as I say, how unusual it is among right. comedies at the time.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it's my absolute favorite of his movies. And when I send people to see their first movie, I wouldn't usually send them to The General because I feel like it plays better when you know his work and his sense of humor a little bit. I would send them to maybe Steamboat Bill Jr., which is maybe my personal favorite of his features,
yeah.
or Sherlock Jr., which is a nice entry point because uh-huh. it's just barely over an hour long. Or see some of his shorts, which don't get seen as often, you know, his 20-minute movies that he was making at the beginning of his career that are just like little perfect little quaffable gems. 1 Week would be a really great first one to see, or Cops. Mm-hmm. But you really can't go wrong. I mean, if you watch a Buster Keaton movie that's from the silent era, you're going to see something great.
Yeah. So you mentioned Steamboat Bill Jr. That's the one I want to talk about because I want you to help our listeners understand before they have a chance to see this daring stunt that he pulls off. I think in Hollywood today, that'd be a stunt man, not Buster Keaton.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's something I should have mentioned when I was saying he did everything in terms of doing the editing and gag writing and stuff. I mean, he was a real stickler about doing the stunts. And there's only one case I can think of in his silent era that he hired someone else to do a stunt. And that's because his character had to pole vault. And that was something that he just thought he would have to train for too many months to do. So he hired a gold medal Olympic pole vaulter to do the stand-in for that stunt. That was in a movie called College. But yeah, in general, he was a huge, huge stickler about it must be my body in frame and it must be fully in frame. You know, he really liked to have the camera far back enough that you could see his whole body in motion and the context that it was moving in, because what he liked to do, and I write about this a lot in the book, was to elicit a gasp and a laugh at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. And he wanted to be funny, but he also wanted to be astounding, and he wanted his audience to be afraid for him, which is a feeling that you often have watching his movies, like, how can someone do that and survive? Mm-hmm. So his probably most famous stunt, and maybe even if your listeners have never seen one of his movies, this might be the image they associate with sure. Keaton or with silent film, is in Steamboat Bill Jr., as you say. It's fairly late in his silent career. The movie's from 1928. And he's standing in front of, well, it's a tornado that's happening, or a hurricane, maybe it is, in this scene. And he's standing in front of a big house, and the entire house front detaches, falls over him. He happens to be standing in this small space where the attic window would be, and it's open. And so he survives the stunt. And that's something that he had actually imagined at a different scale over the course of many years. There's versions of that gag that appear in one of his films with Arbuckle, where it's just a flimsy little stage flat that falls onto Arbuckle. Later on in 1 Week, the short that I mentioned, there's a version of a wall sort of falling on him, but it's, again, something much flimsier. But it had really developed to the point of, you know, building this elaborate set and making a 2-ton house front that could easily have crushed him to death
yeah.
by the time of Steamboat Bill Jr. And that's kind of the ultimate example of the laugh-gasp yeah. combination that I mentioned. That stunt plays really well, even if you know nothing about the context,
right.
which is one of the reasons that it's so frequently gift. You know, like if yeah. you go on Twitter or Instagram or Tumblr and look at some sort of Keaton site, you can see that falling house, which, you know, even as a standalone 3-second image is something that takes your breath away.
Well, I think you may have mentioned this in your book, but what got me is the fact that, you know, if you're the actor sitting there waiting for this house to fall on you and just hoping that you're in the right spot so the window is going to land around you, you're going to be looking for it. But in Keaton's mm-hmm. case, he's not even looking.
Right,
he measured off the number of steps that he apparently thought that window was up the side of the house. And here he is just looking like this oaf that doesn't know what's going on. And bam, he gets the window.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, he's called the stone face for a reason, right? His whole persona is that he's unperturbable, no matter what the chaos
yeah.
is that's swirling around him. And that gag is a great example of that logic taken to its ultimate extreme. But of course, there were a whole team of people, you know, making sure that he was standing in exactly the right spot and that the winds that were blowing from these wind machines were not so strong that they would blow the house front out of place. And the stories, which he confirmed later on about the filming of that moment in Steamboat Bill Jr., are that, you know, the cameraman couldn't watch and the director was off in his tent, not even watching the shoot because they were all so afraid that he would be crushed. I mean, it's not the kind of stunt that you can film twice. You
right,
know, you have
right.
to get it right the first time.
So let's conclude our conversation here today, Dana, with a fascinating little side arm to your book. We all watch the Oscars. We all know about the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, especially thanks to Will. But I wonder if you could share with us just how this thing got off the ground, this thing that produces the Oscars every year. Why was that done?
Oh, I like that question. Yeah, well, that is, you're right, that is only marginally related to Buster, but it is in the sense that it comes from Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM in that period and for decades after. And something that he decided to do at just at this period as the studio system was kind of congealing into place, I guess it was the late 1920s. I think it was right around the time of Transition to Sound that Mayer came up with the idea for the Oscars. I mean, not alone, but that, you know, he and other Hollywood executives decided in the beginning it had to do with unionization. Uh-huh. And, you know, they created a guild of producers that would fight against the unionization and the kind of labor rights of their employees. But along the way, one of the things that they decided to do was to hand out cups, as Louis B. Mayer put it, to hand out trophies and awards to their players, because, as Louis B. Mayer put it, that was a way to kind of keep them happy. You know, yeah. That if you, he said, and this is quoted in the book, something like, I knew that if I gave them cups and awards, they would do anything I wanted. You know, so initially, and that's something really interesting to think about when you're watching the Oscars, the award system was created as a means of control of employees, you yeah. know, and it worked really, really well, because very quickly it became very prestigious to get one of those awards.
Yeah, maybe that's what Amazon is trying to do. Who knows? But anyway.
Yeah, it seems to be a good strategy.
That's right. Well, we've come to the end of our time for this conversation, but I want to thank you so much for being with us today and for writing this book. The book, again, is Cameraman, Buster Keaton, The Dawn of Cinema, and the Invention of the 20th Century. And you get it all in this book by Dana Stevens. Dana, thank you so much for joining us. I also want to commend you on your poem at the beginning of the book. I think readers ought to take a look at that. I thought that was a really nice way to honor Buster's life and career. And your close with a visit to Buster's grave in Los Angeles, I thought was very touching. And that all can be picked up in a copy of Cameraman by Dana Stevens. Thanks for joining us today, Dana.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thanks for the great questions, Bob.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.